Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is the 12th of May 2008, and I'm now sitting with Aaron Wei, who is with the ICDG in Monrovia, Liberia. Well, first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent.
Yeah, I've given my consent, but I'm going to speak to this interview in my capacity as a civil society, a former civil society guy. Because by then I did more work in SSRO than I'm currently doing ICTJ. So all my views and comments and opinions here, you know, are not affiliated with ICTJ. Because in ICTJ I have quite a different responsibility, even though SSRO is somewhat a part of that. But I'm more comfortable with my opinions being linked to civil society.
Okay. Yep. Well, I'd like to start the interview by actually asking you about your personal background, and particularly the positions you've held before coming to work with ICTG. And in what way did you get interested in the security sector in Liberia?
Well, initially I worked for the Center for Democratic Empowerment, and I started off first as a research assistant. And by the time we were like conducting some research, basically to evaluate the United Nations mission in Liberia, 1 year of existence in Liberia, and for the most part to solicit the views of people living in Monrovia in around the suburbs on their thoughts about how they see security in Liberia since the war years. After 1 year of the United Nations mission being in Liberia, and you know, how do they see security? Was it better? Did it improve? Was it bad? And on the other hand, we were also interested in their comparison with how did they regard their safety? Did they feel safe with UN or with the LNP? Or with the LNP, or the
Liberian National Police.
Exactly. So, basically, that was the trend of our interview. And this interview and this project was funded by the NDI,
National Democratic Institute.
Yeah, the NDI, and then with a few other organizations, civil society organizations, and it was quite a very interesting findings that came up later on. By then that was in 2004. And these were the very early beginnings of my involvement into security sector reform. Then I move on in seed and begin a program associate. And then I headed the security sector working group. I was the focal point for the Center for Democratic Empowerment there, the security sector working group. I mean, this is basically a fledgling young civil society think tank aimed at understanding and helping the government to advance positive recommendations on how to improve and how to impact the security sector reform exercise and to advance very good policy recommendations to the government. And as a result of that, we did a best practice exchange visit to 5 different countries around Africa, particularly countries that had their own share of police reform. And we went to South Africa, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Nigeria. Yeah, particularly. And I had a responsibility of documenting the best practices from Ghana. And CDD Ghana provided me a space to do that work. It was about 2 weeks exercise. It was quite very interesting as well. At the moment, that document, the compilation of the different studies should be published into one volume for civil society on record. And it will be used as civil society own tool comparatively how to advise the government on that. Yeah, so
it will be published
in
this year.
I don't know specifically when that's going to be published, but it's still going through some bit of editing by international partners. ICDJ is helping, is doing a tremendous work with the security sector, the working group, the SSR working group, and ICDJ has got some responsibility as an advisor to this group to edit this work. So it's going through a lot of editing by ICDJ as well. It should be published sometime soon, but that's left with civil society involvement as well. And then sometime last year in March, I attended this police reform conference in South Africa, Pretoria, where I delivered this paper on civil society involvement in police reform in Liberia. And this paper is published on the ADASA website, the civil society organization in South Africa. I mean, prior to that, and I joined ICTJ, so that's just a summary of my own history of police reform access and reform work.
Okay. Thank you. Well, as we go into like functional areas of police reform, I'll invite you to draw on your comparative experience as well of what you may have seen in other countries. But first, I'd like to ask you about Liberia and maybe to give us a brief history of the status of public order and crime since the time when you conducted the maybe the first survey in 2004, sort of the evolution, as well as evolution in terms of the major challenges facing the Liberian National Police.
Yeah, as far back as 2004, since we conducted this study, there are still issues that are very present, even from 2004 to now. I mean, during the research study we did, I mean, ordinary Liberians are very keen on police prompt response to crime scene, even when they were called upon on their police hotline. The time it took for police to get it were always, I mean.
The police hotline was established when?
Yeah, I mean, the police hotline had been in existence even prior to the interim government on Attila regime and other. I mean, there have been traditionally a number to get at the police. So, I mean, people became educated to using that. Yeah. But even at that, I mean, there are all the local depots, police depots in communities. And people call on police to respond to the crime incidents. But there have always been concerns, there have always been discontent among community dwellers that the police are not very prompt in these kind of instances. And the police, talking to police, will always talk about logistics, that they never had equal logistics. And it's true. Even up to now, you see the police, I mean, is in as much as they've gotten very good training, but the logistics, I mean, is very incompatible with the training they've gotten. So they just have the theoretical knowledge. But then what runs parallel to that theoretical knowledge is the capacity, the logistical capacity to enforce the training and their own concept, you know, of policing.
What are some of the specifics needs in terms of when you say logistics is incompatible? What's missing?
I mean, vehicles, for example, is one of the impediments. And where vehicles are present, there is a public outcry from certain police units that petroleum is not available. Arms are, you know, not available with the issue of armed robbery in Liberia. I mean, which is a very important part of the Liberian present security reality. Armed robbery is on the rise in Liberia. So, I mean, these are things that are very, very, very important to address. Because currently Liberia has got a population of 3.3 ex-combatant community. I mean, in as much as there have been disarmament, but we have more than 100,000 ex-combatant disarmed. So we have a percentage of about 3.3% approximately. So with that kind of statistics, it's just as good for the police to be informed about the challenges. The challenges that exist, and they should be able to act on that.
So the armed robberies and generally the presence of ex-combatants that still have weapons are some of the major challenges. Are those in terms of crime? And
I mean, another challenge which the police have to deal with is the issue of to some extent how the recruitment exercise, how the public think were a bit flawed. How? Because one of the imperatives of the recruitment and vetting exercise was not to allow people with terrible human rights record back into the police, which was basically, I mean, for the most part, most of the ex-combatants, you know, were not freed from that stigma. And there have been concerns that people that were known as combatants with terrible human rights record are currently wearing police uniforms. And if you can just look at the lens of, just go back at the way the recruitment was done and how the LMP tried to ward off ex-combatants and those with terrible human rights record, you will see how some of the concerns are genuine. I mean, for example, the current training of the military, I mean, the successful candidates that go through the different vetting exercises and are about to be sent on the base have their pictures placed in the street. So if you have an issue with this particular guy, you go and say, look, this guy, you know, is an ex-combatant, or this guy, you know, does not have a good human rights record. But for the police, for the most part, it was just names, basic names, you know, like, you know, was placed around at different areas. I think, if I'm not too sure, it appeared in the newspaper at some point in time. But at the time in Liberia, the police reform was on. It was not sufficient to have the public participate in the scrutiny process and say, look, because during the course of the war, most ex-combatants were using known diggers. They were not using their real names. So putting a real name up was already a disguise. I mean, additionally, the newspapers and the general media at the time was not all around Liberia. In 2004, you had news. There was a study the Center for Democratic Empowerment did. It's like 1% of Liberians in the Monrovia area read newspaper. So that was another issue. So if, for example, the vetting exercise, the LMP considered newspaper, that was a major issue. So it alienated a good part of the population from participating in this public scrutiny process. I mean, another thing that reinforced this particular point of the recruitment and the vetting of the police being a bit flawed was January at the TRC public hearings. There were a lot of testimonies from witnesses that said people that perpetrated abuses on them are currently in the police, and they know them. They were calling them by their full name. I mean, this newly reformed police, I mean, there were more than 3 cases where witnesses came up and said, this happened to me because of this guy, and this guy is currently in the police. This happened to me because of this guy, and this guy is currently in the police. So this further reinforcing, you know, the public outcry after the police reform process got underway, that the process of vetting and the process of recruitment more generally was flawed, and it didn't really, so, you know.
So the vetting process of the police was not linked to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
No, not really. I mean, it wasn't meant to be that way. But, I mean, the example I'm trying to introduce here is like, people were saying that the whole issue of a general participation or the public being involved in saying, I mean, because the whole idea was a public scrutiny. Before anyone go and listen to the police, you have a way of communicating to the public and say, look, this guy, I want to become a police officer. Do you know him? If he has a human rights record, please come forward and say it. This was done on a very low scale, which didn't incorporate, and, you know, which really didn't, I mean, by way of the media, like I said, didn't go beyond Monrovia. If it did, then it did only on posters with only names and not photos. And people needed to see photographs, because Liberia is still a very illiterate society, 76%. So people will not be too familiar with reading names like they would do with pictures, photographs. So, I mean, that was an issue, you know, that needed to be considered seriously. I mean, Monrovia alone is maybe 1/3 of the entire population of Liberia. So more should have been done, you know, to solicit the participation of people in rural Liberia, which was not really done. And this, the public hearing in January, actually reinforced some of these concerns by saying people with bad human rights record are still in the police. And this is what the guy said at the public hearings. The witnesses said that. Not one, not two, but more than three said that. So I'm not saying that we need to like link it up with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. No. I'm just saying that unwittingly, the Truth and Reconciliation process, public hearing brought it up, which actually reinforced some of these concerns made in 2005. Yep.
So we're talking about recruitment. Can you clarify which part of the Liberian National Police comes from the prior police? Uh-huh. Have there been some that have been retired? And then how was the numbers of new recruits decided upon?
I don't think I got you too clear. Maybe you need to state that again.
In terms of the recruitment, mm-hmm. We're talking about the vetting of new candidates. At the time of the transitional government, how many were new recruits versus existing already police force?
The total number of recruits and the old LMP.
What part of the LMP is a new post-conflict? And were there any officers from the prior police force?
Well, I mean, there was a clear instruction to deactivate the entire LMP and recruit a new LMP. That meant if any member of the old LMP was still interested and met the basic criteria set up to join the new LMP, well, he was welcome to do that. But the entire membership of the LMP was deactivated.
That was in what year, the deactivation?
Oh, the deactivation started up in 2005, 2006, around that year.
Okay. So technically, the whole new LMP has been recruited again and vetted.
Yep. Yep. It's safe to say that, yeah.
Were there, aside from what you were mentioning, the posting of the names in the newspapers, were there any attempt to look at human rights records through either civil society organizations or United Nations and Office of High?
Yeah, I mean there was a attempt because the LMP had a section where they were trying to corroborate the information provided by candidates wanting to enlist. So if you come up and say, "I want to enlist," you will go through the preliminary, and they will go through the community you claim to be from, and they will go and do background search on you, talk with neighbors, talk with people about who you are, and you know whether you were suitable for enlisting the new LMP. These were led by most times in the UN police unit, a lot of internationals.
In terms of the minimum criteria for recruitment, mm-hmm. Do you have knowledge of how were these decided and what were they in a country where you have, as you mentioned earlier, 76% illiterate population? Mm-hmm. How were the minimum standards?
Well, the
of
minimum
education and
the minimum standard for education was high school, basic Liberian high school, with the WIAC certificate. The WIAC certificate is the West African Examination Council. It's a regional evaluation done, and everyone that goes to high school is required to have that particular document. But at the very dying meaning, there was some gender consideration to incorporate, because there was a target of reaching 3,000 new members of the LMP. But this number was at a point of already being concluded when the trainers realized that the number of Liberian women in the police were almost very, very minimum. And they did not meet up with the set quota. I mean, there's a quota, I'm not too sure the quota, that should be in the Liberian LMP, but there is a number that was not reached at the end of the day. So there was an additional 500 consideration to have women enlist into the LMP.
Okay.
But then most of the women that wanted to become a part of the LMP did not reach the high school standard. And so there were some fast track secondary accelerator program at the academy so that they are up, they're brought up to speed with basic and basic requirement, high school standard. So there was
They were like basic literacy or like high school education training.
Yeah, most of them were
this academy. Yeah, for these women.
Yeah, most of them were like high school dropouts.
Okay.
Most of them were like high school dropouts that wanted to be a part of. The LMP, and so because they never made it, they didn't read it and get through high school, and LMP wanted to have a very good representation of women there, and so they had to find another way to accommodate women there, and so they drew up this academic program.
Do you
more or less a fast track program to have them brought up to speed on basic secondary stuff? Yeah.
Do you remember when the idea of a quota of female officers was brought about? Was this something along the way that was agreed on?
I'm not too sure on the specificity of that, but it was just before they concluded the 3,000 benchmark, and then they knew that if the 3,000 benchmark was concluded, you will have a new LMP with far less women than expected. So this must have been about a year ago.
So the process of
I mean, we may interrupt this interview.
Should happen.
Great.
Okay. So, second part of the interview with Mr. Aaron Wei. So we were just talking about the introduction of quota for female officers into the police, the Liberian National Police. I'd like now to move into training and professionalization. Mm-hmm. And if you could maybe describe some of the training programs that have been developed. I don't know if you witnessed some of this, or if you possibly have even given inputs to.
Well, I really want to respond to the in-depth, you know, but I know that the curriculum of the LMP changed fundamentally by the inclusion of intensive human rights syllabus. I mean, comparatively looking back at previous police curriculum and the present curriculum, I mean, most of the training the police got emphasized a lot of human rights issues, which is very fundamental to the historic and, you know, curriculum and syllabus the LMP had. I mean, basically, I want to limit my comment to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
In terms of the survey you had conducted on the perception of the police and so on, is the issue? Have you seen evolutions in the issue of human rights after these trainings started being implemented?
Well, yeah, in a way, because I mean the stop, the arbitrary arrest that was very common in Liberia, stopped processing alleged criminals for court was highly respected. I mean, these were things that were really not present in our recent past. So there have been a lot of fundamental change in police conduct of criminal activities. So arbitrary arrest was almost non-existent. I mean, it was very faithful to the issue of processing police and having them sent to, processing criminals and having them sent to court. So these things were very much respected and observed. Yeah.
Well, now maybe we could move to the area where you might have been the most involved in, which is the issue of external accountability of the police. If you could comment on maybe some of the major issues and what are some of the initiatives to try to improve external accountability as well as public perception of the police.
I mean, oversight in the Liberian police is still, something that needs to be grappled with. Oversight is very much important. I mean, as a way of checkmating police activities for society like Liberia, where the police does not enjoy, you do not enjoy confidence of the general public, oversight is very key. And this is something that civil society has been doing, a couple of trainings, been participating with a lot of organizations. But at the moment, civil society does not feel strongly that they have got a lot of recognition in dealing and working along with security institutions. I mean, police reform exercise went on in Liberia with almost no input. If there were any input, well, it was very, very marginal. So the strength of civil society is to speak to issue of civil, of oversight and work with local communities in bringing it up to speed in terms of how the issue of oversight needs to be introduced in the police reform exercise. So that in terms of external and police expectations, the issue of oversight need to be seriously considered. Additionally, the study I did when I was with civil society was bringing best practices from other countries in the region and outside West Africa is also very important. I mean, the more security institutions collaborate with civil society, the more they get to know about what happened in other contexts, how these things were resolved. So the state is definitely going to be of no use if there is now an open corridor to engage with police institutions. So that also needs to be noted. And
what are some of the best practices from outside that you've identified and maybe shared with the government, as you were saying, in your previous position with the Center for Democratic Empowerment, you were making policy recommendations as well. What are some of these best practices you've identified?
I mean, one of them I just mentioned is the issue of oversight. How in countries like Liberia, just coming from a civil conflict, it would be very useful if the community gets very much involved in accounting for the conduct of police. If there are ombudsmen, for example, set up in Sierra Leone, ombudsmen set up in other contexts, and establish here where police are examined and are made to account for misdeeds, and the community can make this kind of referral to IS authorities and say, look, this guy is not behaving according to standard. I mean, for the restoration of confidence and respect to the police, the community needs to speak independently to authorities, and these guys need to be accounted. Be accountable to.
When you talk about the example of Sierra Leone, are you talking about the complaint and internal investigation mechanism, or the community partnership boards from Sierra Leone?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's very similar to that, but then it coordinates with the community oversight mechanism, and almost ombudsman and kind of standards like that.
Are there other best practices from other countries that you've identified potentially applicable in the Liberian context?
Yeah, I mean, precisely, but this one is more or less not police reform related, because when I did this study in Ghana, it was like the reform in Ghana was more like driven by the military, because the problem has been on the military, so the best practices, they are very much unique to the military, so I won't like to, it would be a bit inappropriate to talk about the military best practice in our police reform interview.
I mean, it's all related to security
sector.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
As a whole.
Yeah.
So it would be for the military, the lessons from Ghana would be here
mostly,
for the military,
yeah, mostly,
as well.
Mostly. But one thing that was very overriding when I did the interview with the police, with few police and civil society organization doing a study in Ghana, was that civil society was very much involved, and civil society communicated every different progress the reform was making to the general society. And another unique thing that came about was how the police historically and the military in Ghana was almost at conflict because the police felt that the military was usurping their function. But under this new reform in Ghana, that was resolved. And in most times, the military was seen to be into mutual partnership with the police and complementing the police efforts when necessary. So, I mean, the whole reform exercise introduced a new consideration on police-military relations, which is a very good thing to borrow from. I mean, the military and the police need to see, you know, themselves as complementing and security institutions. So that was very much highlighted in the course of the study, yeah.
Are there any existing oversight mechanisms or at least internal accountability mechanism in the current Liberian National Police?
I'm not too sure about that, but that has been talked about a lot. I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Yeah. But another good best practice, even though general in nature and security institutions was, I mean, the Ghanaian reform stuff have a 1996 Security Act that incorporates all the different security institutions as opposed to our current security operations in Liberia, where almost all the different security institutions are accommodated individually by different statutes. Mm. Yeah, they're all operating by different statutes. But the Ghana has got a one security legislation, which I think Liberia needs to borrow from. This is why the amalgamation stuff is very important. Yeah.
Amalgamation of different services. So what is the existing situation? How many security services are there in Liberia?
We got currently more than 10 security institutions in Liberia, all established on a different statute. Yeah.
And is there a discussion at the government level, the society level, on the possible integration of these 10 security institutions?
No, they
do they respond to different ministries right now?
Well, I mean, what we need is amalgamation, and what we need to borrow from the Ghanaian best practice of having a single legislation that establishes different security units is that currently in Liberia, you got more than 10 security institutions established by different sets of legislation. And to repeal this different legislation, you need a different legislative assembly to do that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, these more than 10 security institutions in Liberia have overlapping functions, and they have got a lot of budgetary constraints to the government. For a country in the coming out of war of a terrible economy, we need to quickly jump at the opportunity of amalgamation.
So this is a consideration. Do you have any aside from like the problem of drawing on big budgets and in terms of the overlapping functions, do you have specific examples where this multiplicity of agencies has created problems or frictions? Do you have any illustrations?
We have the Liberian National Police that has a unit to deal with drug and other related crimes activities. I mean, and you have the you have another agency called the DEA on drugs. So there is sometimes and confusion over the mandates. The LMP has got some broad mandates to deal with drugs related stuff, and while the DEA was established specifically to track down drug related incidents or crime in the country. So that need to be looked at as well.
Coming back for a second at the lack of public confidence, what are the principal reasons? You mentioned earlier the arbitrary arrests that were common before.
Yeah.
What are some of, is corruption a major issue in terms of the public confidence?
Exactly. I mean, and what is underpinning that corruption is the low compensation for police officers.
Sure.
So the guys are paid very less, and the state has a huge demand on their time to deliver up to professional standard. And to compensate, you know, for the demand, the guys are very easily susceptible to taking bribes.
Mm.
in full view of the public. And so the public sees that and have no respect for this guy. But the chain effect is that he's been underpaid.
To give an idea or a reference, can you give us like the salary of an officer in comparison maybe to a teacher or some other functions in society?
I mean, interestingly, it's pretty much the same. I mean, if I can just run you through, if an LMP that is a recruit and goes at the academy makes $30, when he's leave the academy and come up for internship training before he's admitted as a full LMP, he makes $45. When he's admitted as a full-fledged LMP, he makes $90. That is the take-home pay for the end of every month. And that is the pay he survives on if he's transferred from here to Maryland, which is almost like 2 hours drive, 2 days drive. So he used that to pay rent, and he used that to do every other thing. So with that $90, you can imagine, you know. But then the minimum wage in Liberia is like $50, approximately $50.
Okay, so they start almost below the minimum wage at $45. Oh, in the training.
Yeah, in the training.
And then 90 when
90, yeah. So
okay. And 50 is the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Are there any issues of politicization of the police service in Liberia?
Well, it came up a bit, I think, in 2005 when the president made an announcement that she will want members of her partisans, or she want partisans to be trained in the key security position like the SSS, and that created a bill of row.
Partisans?
Yeah, partisans of this current party. The Unity Party.
Okay.
She made some announcement that she would appreciate if more of her partisans get trained as security officers. I mean, that was very, very controversial for the police reform agenda, for this the normal security sector reform agenda.
So she wanted to be them trained as part of the different services, existing police
well,
or
she
or
just
services.
She just made a statement generally. That she won, you know.
And what were the reactions and what followed this announcement?
People condemned it because it was very, very similar to what we experienced over the past decade, two decades or so. So people saw that statement was tantamount, you know, to introducing the old order of security operations in Liberia.
So, are there any safeguards on the potential use of security apparatuses as a tool for a certain political party or so on?
No, but I mean
to make it a neutral police force. Yes.
Yeah, because the safeguard there is the one of the expectations of the security sector reform program in Liberia is to have or equal geographic representation. So that alone, you know, carries a lot of weight in making sure that you have a new police force that reflects of geographical balance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that said, you know, people are anxious that we'll consider in all the different ethnic and have ethnic considerations as well. Yeah.
One last area is the non-state security groups. Can you describe for us some of the non-state security groups existing in Liberia and maybe what their relation with the Liberian National Police is?
Non-state security
groups. Meaning either private security or vigilante groups and so on.
Well, non-state security group for now will... Not really. We don't really have a proliferation of that. We have what we do have. We have, like you just mentioned,
the private security groups.
Yeah, we have
that are not armed.
Yeah, private security groups that are not armed, but they're not really considered. I mean, interestingly, these guys are not considered seriously in the drafting of the Liberian security architecture. They're not considered. They're quite basically because these are guys that get hired just loosely like that without much security training. So they're not considered very seriously as we a paramilitary, so to speak, here. So like any other guy walking on the street and just say, look, I got a job for you to be a security officer, just come and mine property. So they're not really considered seriously along that line. But vigilantism now in Liberia is like, there was a controversial statement made by the former justice minister, who is now commerce minister, trying to mobilize local community into vigilantism when armed robbery were very high last year. At a certain point, armed robbery really came on the rise, and in her capacity as a justice minister, she actually like mobilized through a public statement that people should come up in her community and form, you know, into vigilantism or into vigilante, and see how they could help to curb the increasing rate of armed robbery. And human rights institutions condemned that, and it was very incompatible with human rights standards. And looking at who vigilantes are and looking at mob violence in Liberia, that was a recipe, you know, for complete disaster. So
so only the Liberian National Police carries weapons in Liberia. They have
no Liberian their state is thought on. Liberian National Police do not really carry weapons. There are just a few that just do that.
Only the support unit.
The ones that are assigned to maybe the directors carry weapon. But generally, Liberian LMP, there is not being, that decision have to be made by the president. And given the...
It's an unarmed police right now.
Yeah.
The beat.
The police are unarmed.
They
are unarmed, yeah. So it's only the president can make that decision in consultation perhaps with the UN. So Liberian police are largely unarmed.
Now we've looked at different areas, a number of different areas. In terms of the broader police reforms, what are some of the broader challenges of today, looking at the future? And maybe, in your opinion, what are some tasks that should be prioritized when looking at police reform?
Well, I think right now, one of the biggest challenges is how the central challenge now is Liberia has got a terrible economy. I mean, the last budget was $179 million for a whole country. I mean, that's absurd. Yeah, that's $179 million. And the security component to that, I mean, if you, it is reflected in the monthly pay of ordinary police officer, $90. So these are some of the backgrounds to why public confidence, you know, is yet to be desired of the police, because the guys are constrained by these conditions to openly accept bribe. And also logistics in, I mean, ordinary Liberians do not really feel secure with a police officer around, because that is yet to be done. Ordinary guy in a situation of crime will easily call on his community in a mob action to find safety than to call on an LMP, because they usually come bare hand. Sometimes they complain there's no fuel in the car. Sometimes they complain there's no logistics available. So Liberians, in the current state of mind, feel safe through vigilantism, unfortunately. So that's a huge challenge. And that challenge needs to be tackled through the economy. There need to be, I mean, the compensation for these guys in a highly crime-ridden society like Liberia, with a very huge ex-combatant community, they need to be compensated in a way that the issue of bribery is behind them. They need to be taken care of in a way that they can be with adequate logistics that can make them very, very and capacitated to be able to stand in a real crime environment. That so until these things can be done, I mean, Liberians will still, I mean, just see the police as just another unit, you know, and but
ideally don't really feel secure. You know, when police are around. So, I mean, the bottom to that is our economy is in a terrible shape. That's the challenge. And if all need to be done with different security units, that would be the first thing that would need to be taken care of. And then policymakers need to see the reason to review securities compensation in a bureau. And additionally, we need to look at the issue of logistics, which is the basis, you know, for providing the kind of security that a post-conflict state requires.
We've discussed a couple of best practices they identify in other countries. Are there any innovations or experiments either here in Liberia or in another country that we haven't talked about yet that you think merit more attention? An innovation or experiment, uh-huh. whether it be a specific unit or a specific kind of training that's been done, or just a measure that's been taken, either here in Liberia, as it pertains to the Liberian National Police, or in another country that you've visited through your work, that you think is quite important and should merit attention.
Well, on that note, I mean, right now the government is very hesitant to arm the police because of our own experience with violence, our own experience with weapons. But given the increase in armed robbery, most Liberians now are of the opinion that the police should be armed. Along that line, I would suggest, or I would think, it would be good to experiment with a small unit, train, you know, to do armed robbery and violent crimes of that nature. So I would think, you know, for now, a small unit need to be taxed with that, and not necessarily the entire police force. Mm. So yeah, I think, you know, that on that note, that's my thought on why we need to experiment with to deal with that. Okay. Yeah.
One last question, if you allow me. No, we've talked about the Liberian National Police, now I'd like to turn to the donor community and to the UN Police and the United Nations in general. Are there some lessons from their involvement in the security sector reform in Liberia, or more specifically in the police reform, in terms of what is maybe has been done well and maybe things that could have been done better in terms of their involvement?
Well, I can only speak on that note with respect to the kind of support civil society have had from the international community. Yeah. Like I talk about this exchange visit for civil society organization to document best practice. Mm-hmm. The International Center for Transitional Justice has been very, very helpful and very supportive of that particular effort. We're one of the organizations that really encouraged capacity of local civil society organization to be really enhanced so that they could deal with the competing needs, you know, of civil society own effort to partner with the Liberian police, to partner with international organizations to get the whole security sector program underway. And the center, along with a few other international NGOs, have helped organize a civil society group into a security sector, a SSR working group. As I mentioned previously, this group is more or less a fledgling think tank trying to draw on comparative studies, comparative experiences of police security sector reform in a way, you know, of carving out unique approach for the Liberian own situation. And this has been very helpful. They have been this security sector group are so far.
So including five countries, as you mentioned, right? South Africa, Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria.
Yep. I mean, this group have been the only group so far that have brought policymakers from government, both parliamentarians, ministers, to the table to try to address, and government should see the need of trying to open up to civil society and so that they can work. I mean, this is very important because Liberia have got a history where security in this country has been seen as a no-go area for civilians. I mean, there has been a historical mentality that civilians or non-security personnel are not allowed to discuss security issues. So there's a major barrier. That was a milestone. The Security Sector Working Group, along with the International Center for Transitional Justice, helped to pull that off by having the launching of the SSR Working Group and having parliamentarians from government, having ministers, even having the United States Embassy through its military, you know, representative there. That was a very big event in 2005. Yeah.
That was the launching, and now...
Yeah, it was the launching of the...
So there'll be follow-up conferences and...
Yeah, there have been. The secretariat is trying to get it asked together and try to be a very independent secretariat. And
where will they be based?
They'll be based here in Monrovia. Secretariat will be based in Monrovia. It's presently a coalition comprising nine different civil society organizations. The Press Union, Liberia, Center for Democratic Empowerment, the Liberian Action Network on Small Arms. You got women groups there, you have Ford, you got several other organizations there. So it's quite a very interesting make, I mean, if I can put it that way. I mean, a cross-sectional civil society organization poised to speak to security sector reform issues.
Before we close the interview, do you have any final comments?
Well, I mean, I would appreciate if you can speak to a few groups of the Security Sector Working Group, and even speak to ICDJ person on that, Lansbury, who I told you about. He's the head of the Monrovia office. And, I mean, the working group need to know about this kind of study so that they can draw from the enormous resources being put into this exercise. Because Liberia, until this whole exercise of security sector reform is going to continue for the next decade if we are to be any better. And so we need these kind of resources to be able to enhance our own capacity every other time.
Mr. Aaron Wei, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Arthur.